Alan, about how much time did you spend investigating the state farms?
Well, I spent, I spent the whole year, obviously doing the research. But at the end of the year, Professor Loza, who was my director, and he just would see me about once a month, and we'd talk about my research interests. I didn't take any classes there. My education was primarily in the archives. He said, I'm going to give you a break. I'm going to let you go live on a farm for a month. I'm going to let you see one of our farms. Well, this is unique, man. I hadn't had any, no one had an opportunity like that. He says, you're going to go down to the Kuban, to the soft horse Kuban, and you're going to spend a month there with them. We have nothing to hide, he said. right? Although it was one of the prize, state farms down there. So I went down there, down to what's called Krasnodarsky Krai. It's still beautiful, kind of flow to the name, down to Krasnodar. And I went down there, and I walk into the party headquarters. Actually, the party headquarters are probably the administrative headquarters. But I walk in there, and there sitting in front of me is, the party secretary for the oblast. And then beside him is a guy with a scar on his head. And he says, so-and-so, he says, Mr. Ballard, he says, this fellow here is going to be with you on the farm for the month. And he pointed to this fellow, who was Gorbachev, Michael Mikhail Gorbachev, who was at that time the secretary of the Komsomol, that is, of the secretary of the youth organization, on the state, in that whole oblast, in that whole region. So I went to the farm, and there on the farm, we stay in the same dormitory. I'm on the first floor, and on the second floor is Gorbachev with his wife, Raisa, and their little daughter, I believe. And Gorbachev, whom I call Misha, right? He was Misha for me. Right? I didn't know he was Gorbachev then, right? Misha was with me the whole month. He didn't, it's not like he was with me all day long. He really had a job to do. They were sowing. It was May. And they were sowing the seeds and stuff of that sort. So he was out on the farm and directing stuff going on, making sure everything was working. He was a great guy. I mean, in terms of, you've never seen so much energy. Right? And he wore this little cap on his head, peaked on the side like that. You've seen these Russian peasant caps, right? He's had a cap. He walked that, and he'd had this tremendous rapport with the tractor drivers. I mean, common touch with him, because he's from there. Now, his folks had been caught up in the kulaks and all that thing earlier on. So he's from there, and he's got this touch. Everybody, hey, Misha, cock to Misha. Back and forth, the way the Russians banter back and forth. So every night, by now he's a lawyer. He'd finished Moscow University, and he was a whip. In his mind, he was one of the sharpest guys I've ever met in my life. He would sit me down at night, because that's what we do. We drink this sweet wine. They had the sweet wine. And it's so sweet, it'd make you sick if you kept drinking it. But, it's sweet wine. And we'd sit there, and all night long, we'd argue. Sometimes I remember Rice in the other room, right? We're in there arguing, and Rice isn't kind. She'd just get up. She'd get up and walk out of the room, although she was smart too. She was a philosophy, right? And she would sometimes, but now he just bump it, bump it, bump. And we argued over everything. Noel, he's saying, Noel, we start talking about the poverty in the United States. What about the Negroes in the United States? The workers fighting back and forth. That's what we did. Then the big pinnacle of that was when the U-2 came over here I am stuck down in this daggone farm, right? And the U2 comes over, and Gary Powers is shot down, right? And Khrushchev gives his speech. Well, there's this big, and there's a big courtyard on the farm. And it's these big speakers, because, you know, Russia didn't have a million, they didn't have cable TV. They had these big speakers. And this speaker's out going over the courtyard. And Khrushchev comes on with his speech about Eisenhower. Well, I'm standing there. I'm saying, this is feeling very funny, man, because all around me are all these peasants, right? And Gorbachev is right behind me, right? And Khrushchev is up there talking, saying how the Americans have betrayed him. Particularly, I remember that one phrase, "Мой друг, my friend Eisenhower," right? And how he betrayed me. And, you know, I'm sitting there, as he's gone, Gorbachev, because I've been telling him how we were good people and all this stuff, right? You know, that's right. Every time he said, boom, hit me in my back of my head. No, Al, smotricha, Al, smotricha. He hit me in my back every time something. He said, do you see that? See that? Do you see that? Dun, 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 dun. Fine, I just got tired of listening to him, man. I went over to I sat down someplace, and he came back. He came in when the speech was over. He kept on, right? So that's him. He was really a great guy. You know, I mean, you could see he was, you know, not ordinary people, man. He was what he was.
It seems like you got quite a bit from that year.
It was good.
So you received, you did that research, mm-hmm. and you came back mm-hmm. to Harvard, and you completed your degree when?
I became my degree about 1960. So 1960, and came back to Harvard, and then I had to get a job. And that was pretty rough, being a black academic at the time, again. I applied to a couple of black colleges, and I never heard back from them. I really wanted to teach in a black college for a lot of reasons, mainly because I really wanted to be back with my people. And however, that didn't work out, and it ended. But, you know, I'll just tell you a funny story. I was given an offer to teach at the University of Virginia at the same time. The University of Virginia in 1960 offered me a job as a professor of assistant professor of political science to teach Russian studies. The offer came in by phone, right? And I was astounded because, you know, this wasn't going to happen. And I went and I told Professor Feinsod, and he said, oh, they called you. I said, yeah, they did. He said, I recommended you. I said, fine. He said, but they're in Virginia. Well, Professor Feinsod basically was such a solid scholar, he doesn't even think about race at all. Not at all. I mean, this thing didn't faze him one way or another. So I said, well, I can't take the job, because they don't know I'm black. And so he said, well, see what you can do about it. And so I went and I called up the guy who had offered me the job and called him back. I said, do you know, I said, I'm black. And he said, oh, my God. Like that. He said, oh, my God, no. I said, yes. Right? Because Feinsod and Adam Ulam had basically recommended me, you know, without saying anything about my race. And he says, we'll have to withdraw the offer. And I said, I know that. So he did, and that was that. I ended up after that at City College in New York, and where they were happy to have me, where I was part of a great political science department with some incredible scholars there, Ivo Dukacek, John Hertz. These are great people in international relations. Randy Braham, a great man in Holocaust studies, were just wonderful people there. John Davis, a fine African-American scholar of politics. So that's where I ended up, at City College in New York. And that's where I spent the first part of my career, actually.
For a quarter of a century.
For a quarter of a century. That's true. A long time. Right.
As
right.
a professor and as an administrator.
Yeah, as a professor and as an administrator, right. Yeah.
I want to focus in on your administrative initiatives and some of the pioneering work you did in the pre-baccalaureate program and the predecessor to the EOP programs, the Equal Opportunity programs.
Yeah.
Could you talk about the politics of that, how you got into it? Just take us through the story of that, because I think that's really a path-breaking part of your career at that stage in your life.
Yeah, well, what happened was I got to City College. And, you know, number one, I didn't like being outside of Philadelphia. I guess I was still a Philly boy at heart, realistically. But I was in New York, and I said to the college, I got swept up into, it was an all-white environment. City College was very liberal. You know, it had a high Jewish population, as you know, and the faculty was heavily Jewish, as was the faculty, just the student body itself. And this City College was a vehicle of upward mobility for the white Jewish community, which had, in effect, been shut out of Ivy League schools by quota systems earlier on in the 1930s and so on. Those students were brilliant. City College was just full of brilliant kids. You know, at one time it had the highest number of PhDs going on, of students going on to PhDs in the country. But this was upsetting to me. What was upsetting to me was that there were no black students there, realistically. I taught my first four or five years, I may have had four black students in the undergraduate day session. I taught night sessions sometimes, and there might be two or three in a class. But basically, blacks were shut out by the high school admission scores because there were not enough black achieving students in the high schools in New York City for them to gain admission to City College, which had scores, and it's also slipping my mind now, but scores in the upper 80s you had to need to get into City College in New York. Well, it looked like it was a merit system. And it was a merit system. You know, you did well, fine, you got in there. But you had this huge dichotomy, this huge schism in the sense that here you have this college. It's right in the center of Harlem. And it was like a taunt to Harlem. You have this entire black community surrounding it, and these kids can't get into the school. Well, you see, I think back in elementary school, I had all these bright kids in my own school who were much smarter than me and who never made it by virtue of whatever, of health or circumstances, economic circumstances. And I have never felt, I mean, from that time on, I never did feel there was any kind of lid on what could be done with a student. So in the midst of a whole lot of burgeoning black nationalism in Brooklyn and various kinds of conflicts going on, I became radicalized. I guess maybe my experience in Russia was added to it, whatever, right? But I became radicalized, and I basically devised a program to admit underachieving black students in small numbers into City College in a program called the pre-baccalaureate program. I did the program. I created it. I wrote it up, and I got the president of City College and the faculty senate of City College to approve the program, which became the very first EOP program. It was a very, very... It was a well-tailored program. I mean, we had, now, number one, we selected, and I say we, I had a lot of help with some very good friends on the faculty, right? We selected the students individually from high schools. We would look over every transcript and bring in, see if a black or Puerto Rican kid, because we brought in 100 of them, half and half. We brought these kids into the college, and we would go over the transcripts and look for possibilities and see where they did excel and whether there was an upward trend in their transcripts. So we brought in those students and put them on campus. And we had great teachers in that program that was created there. Addison Gale, who's a famous black writer, and just very Tony Cade, Bambara, Barbara Christian, who was out there at the University of California later on. We had talented teachers, Adrienne Rich, right, the famous poet. They all were there, and they focused on creating, taking these kids through a transitory one-year period and then moving them into the actual college curriculum. We had great success with it, not the greatest success in the world, but enough success so that there was, we soon got all kinds of political backing from Percy Sutton and from Basil Patterson, Charlie Rangel, who were all up here in the black, up in the state capitol, to fund it at all of the colleges in the city university. And it became called the SEEK program. And then upstate here, Arthur Eve saw what was happening downstate, and he forced the creation of the educational opportunity programs in the state system, following the lead of the SEEK program. So it burgeoned into that. And, you know, it was something that for me, I think, was bittersweet in the sense that I love scholarship and I love writing, but it took me into a tangled world of administration. And again, you know, you learn things from life. I'm a lot tougher person because of having gone through that administrative stuff, because it's a fight every day. And you see people's interests at stake. And, you know, everybody seems to have a legitimate claim. And you have to, you know, in the midst of all that, try to keep focus on what was my primary goal, which was to get the black kids and Puerto Rican kids through college. But everything doesn't work that way sometimes. You know, the students themselves began to get into a state of ferment because this is the 1970s, right? The 1960s. And they started getting into a stage of ferment. And next thing you know, there's chaos on the campus, right? And everything, you know, we know about unintended results. But I think what happened was that in the midst of the program, in the midst of the changes, in the midst of the world changes taking place, there's a lot of chaos. And it didn't end up being what I wanted it to be. I had envisioned like a Kenyan college sitting on City College's campus. That kind of environment, you know, where the kids would be able to kind of focus on the liberal arts and on minds getting enlightened. And what happened instead was that, you know, politics of the city of New York got so enmeshed with everything that suddenly we had an open admissions program, which was underfunded, and, you know, a huge white backlash, you know, which led to neoconservatism. I sometimes tell people, I said, you got this war here in Iraq, I said, because of us. Because basically the neoconservative movement, you know, started by Crystal,
Irving Kristol.
Yeah, Irving Kristol came out of this reaction by the heavily Jewish alumni of City College to what they saw as an assault on the standards of City College and on their traditions. And I understand that. I understand what it was. They had been such marvelous kids. I mean, these students were tough. I went in there when I first started teaching at City College in a Soviet Union course. I mean, they were challenging me on Trotsky. You know, I mean, by verse. You know, that kind of thing. Guys, the kids get in class, but did you read this? You know, wow. They were great students. And, you know, something was being lost by the Jewish community in particular. And this was exacerbated by all that stuff going on in Brooklyn, you know, the school wars. And the quota system itself. Because quotas mean that you're letting somebody in and, you know, somebody's being shut out. And when you apply that kind of a system, it's not fair. Now, somebody ends up having the short end of the stick. And in this particular situation, the white students were saying what they deemed to be unqualified, right, black students being illegitimately, so to speak, brought into the institution without having to pass the standard qualifications. Well, this thing has ramifications all, you know, through the entire society. And, you know, objectively, you can sit back and you can see everybody's kind of point of view on this kind of thing, right? I worked hard. I did this. I did that. And left out of the equation with the Puerto Ricans and as it was then and the African Americans is the whole slave. It's the whole slave heritage. You know, the whole Southern system that basically sent the African Americans into the cities with totally underprepared educations, right, segregated systems, into schools that were segregated, right, in the North frequently because that's what happened. And there's a total lack of understanding on everybody's side. So that's what led to the wars. And it was rough. It was rough. I mean, City College itself descended at times into like a war scene. It was sad, man. You see smoke around there, cops all around there, and, you know, just up and down the place. And, you know, I was saddened by it. When all was said and done, I loved what we had been able to do with the students, you know, with the SEEK program. And because now, when I think about it, I think the SEEK program, if you ever go to any of these situations in New York City or places, everywhere I go, I run the SEEK students. And I think we created the basis of the black middle class, a lot of the black middle class, Puerto Rican middle class in the city of New York by that program, right? Did it ever reach the heights that you really would want? No, right? Did it give African-American kids in high school and Puerto Rican kids in high school something to aspire to? Did the ones that we had in school or the ones who didn't even make it in school, what about their kids? It's amazing now how the kind of generational impetus. I have Sikh students. We had Sikh students from the past who have Harvard kids now, their children, right? And we have black and Puerto Rican administrators all over the city. They came. They're Sikh people and stuff. So, you know, it's like life. There's no justice. And, you know, you try to do your best every day with what you've got. And we're never going to be right about anything all the time.
Lots of things to ponder.
Yeah.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for spending so much time with us talking about your life and your work. For those who want more details, you might check out Alan Ballard's book, Breaching Jericho's Walls, A 20th Century African-American Life, published by SUNY Press. Thank you again.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it. Longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'aime.